Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Somebody who can be constantly changing, constantly trying to change himself into somebody else. But it seems also as if the poem is suggesting that all of those changes are in the service of getting back to the self that he was 20 years ago, and the self not just in himself, but also in all his relationships. That even though 20 years have passed, you might think that things would have changed at home, things have changed, but he can fix that. He can kill all the invaders. He can reestablish his marriage on exactly the same footing that it was 20 years ago, reestablish his relationship with his son. Everything could be exactly the same as it was 20 years ago. And I think the poem is also showing us the ways that fantasy might not fully work. Most obviously in the way that Penelope constantly says that she's marked by tears, that she's changed by grief, that she's not actually the same as she was 20 years ago. But that we also see it, for instance, in the ways that the dog is, this is one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the poem, right? That Argos the dog has been waiting for his old owner, Odysseus, to come back for 20 years, and he finally sniffs him and hears his voice and pricks up his ears, and then he dies. Because in fact, for dogs, you can't stop time, you can't turn back to the way you were 20 years ago, because that's a whole lifetime. So I think it's also playing around with this question of, even without being immortal, even without staying with Calypso forever, is it possible for a human being to be themselves, fully themselves, despite whatever changes, over the course of this long, decades-long period? Or might it be that maybe through no choice of your own, through the things that happen to you, the people you meet, the things that are imposed on you, the situations that are imposed on you, might things actually change you?
What is the Odyssey, and how does this epic poem speak to the 21st century? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to explore those questions with British classicist Emily Wilson, whose new translation of the Odyssey has just been published by W.W. Norton & Company, where Emily argues, it is a poem that has the power to speak to people from many different social backgrounds in the contemporary Anglo-American world. Emily goes on to argue the canonical status of Homer, combined with the philosophical and ethical challenges involved in treating these poems as a source of truth, led to a tradition of allegorizing the various adventures of Odysseus. So, how much of the Odyssey reflects real historical events, and what is its status in the Western canon?
My name is Emily Wilson. I'm a professor of classical studies and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania, the university in Philadelphia in the States. And I grew up in Oxford, England, and I read classic literary humaniores at Oxford. Then I did an MPhil in English literature, and then I did a PhD at Yale in classics and comparative literature. And I've worked on various aspects of classical literature and ancient philosophy and the reception of antiquity in later eras, especially in the early modern period. And over the last 10 years or so, I've got really interested in both the theory and practice of translation. So I've translated some first translations of Seneca's tragedies, of some tragedies by Euripides. And now, most recently, I've done a first translation of the Odyssey in iambic pentameter, which, of course, it's a much translated poem, and I was trying to bring out different elements in the original that I felt were represented by most contemporary translations.
Congratulations on the translation of the Odyssey, Emily. I have to say it was a vibrant read, very stimulating. And I must commend you on your introductions to the text, because they were incredibly informative and accessible for a whole range of different types of readers. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. Is it fair to say that the Odyssey is a poem that travels with you all through life, and within it, the different questions that the different players in the poem bring up also resonate in different ways, given anybody's experience as they journey through life?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, for me personally, I first encountered the story when I was 8 years old, when I was in a elementary school production of the, a kid's version of the Odyssey, and I got to play the goddess Athena, which is really thrilling. And I think I definitely related to the story on certain deep emotional levels, but I wouldn't have been able to say exactly why. I mean, I loved it as a story about feeling out of place and about wandering and not quite knowing where you are. And I think as I've gotten older, I've sort of resonated. Some of the things that have resonated much more deeply with me have been to do with how identity is formed against the places that you're in and the relationships that you have, and how identity might change over time. I mean, Odysseus has this central protagonist who tries to be many different people and also to be nobody. And that whole question about who are you and how is who you are defined by the places you are, and what is home, what is it to be either different or same from who you used to be. Those kinds of questions, I think, change as you get older.
And I can imagine whether if you're a parent or not, or you've had a great love in your life and you're looking at relationships and commitment or whatever it is, that the poem will speak to you in very different ways.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I feel like both sides of the Odysseus-Penelope marriage, like both sides of questions about loyalty, questions about what is it to have a long-term relationship, what is it also to feel angry or abandoned, and those questions also resonate differently. And I'm the mother of three daughters. I definitely also feel much more interested in these various different parent and quasi-parent relationships that are there in the poem, both Odysseus and his father, Odysseus and his dead mother, Telemachus and his difficult relationship with his mother, Telemachus and his also difficult relationship with his father, the various quasi-parents that Telemachus, Odysseus' son, encounters in the course of the poem, that he has a quasi-parental relationship with the old slave, Eumaeus, and also with his father's old buddies, Nestor and Menelaus. So I think it's sort of framing all these different questions about what is a real parent, what is a real parental relationship, to what extent are those relationships always fraught and painful, what is it that defines particular relationships?
And what is a wife and what is a husband, and within that how we understand our roles within relationships?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I guess also the fact that Odysseus has so many different intense relationships with smart female characters. I mean, I think that also is a way of that the poem sets up both the central or for the plot defining arc of getting back with Penelope, but also that we see him with multiple other female characters, including maybe most sustainedly Athena, but then also with we see how he connects with Helen, we see how he connects with Calypso, Circe, Nausicaa, even Eurycleia, the old nurse. So we see these various different binary relationships, each of which, of course, is deep and important, but it's not that only the marital relationship matters.
So for anyone who hasn't read The Odyssey, can you briefly sketch out the story and what exactly happens? And I know a lot happens.
A lot happens. In a way, it's difficult to sketch the plot because the plot is surprising. The plot doesn't quite start where you expect. It's the story of the Nostos. Nostos means homecoming. Of Odysseus from Troy. But it doesn't sort of start in a linear way with here's Odysseus leaving Troy and this is exactly what happens day by day until he gets there. Instead, it starts almost at the end of the geographical journey. It begins with the journeys of Telemachus while his father is away. And then it's only in book five that we get to the sort of backstory of how Odysseus has been lost at sea and the various different strange encounters that he's had with different cultures, different peoples along the way. And then halfway through the poem, he arrives back geographically in Ithaca, but that's not the completion of his Nostos, because of course he also has to figure out how to rebuild his household, how to reforge the relationships from which he's been absent for 20 years, and also learn how to kill the suitors who've been surrounding his wife Penelope for the last few years. The whole question of what is it to rebuild a home is central to the plot.
And, you know, when you think about some of the challenges that parents and men and women are facing today in their own lives, ideas on what it means to have a home, belonging, and all those types of themes are so relevant today, aren't they?
They are relevant today. I mean, I think they're also relevant to questions that, of course, are very, very resonant right now about immigration, migration, refugees.
Yeah.
It's the question of if somebody shows up at your door in this poem, there's this idea that they might be a god or a hero in disguise. Even if they're looking ragged and dirty, you should let them in. That's called xenia, and Zeus watches over that. So questions about hospitality. And I think the poem is also complex about that question about to what extent should we let other people into our homes? Because on some level, it shows us both how it can go right and also how it can go horribly wrong. When you let other people into your homes, then they can turn out to be suitors who eat all your food, and then you have to kill them.
One of the questions you tackle in your introductions to the text is the authorship of the poem. And I'm just wondering, from all your research and all your reading, when was the Odyssey composed? What can we actually say? And why and how can we attribute it to Homer?
Yes, I mean, there's a funny saying that the Odyssey was in the Iliad, but actually not written by Homer, but somebody else of the same name. Nobody really knows who wrote these poems, and nobody really knows how exactly they got to be written poems at all. They're based on a centuries-old oral poetic tradition, because the Greek-speaking world was illiterate for many centuries. And scholars still disagree about how exactly did that process happen, that they got composed as these monumental poems, which seemed too long to be composed, to be performed all at once in a single oral performative context. So possibly some genius poet at the end of the tradition recited for a scribe. Perhaps there were several people who got together to compose these monumental works. And we really don't know. What we do know is that presumably they were composed at some point or other in the late 8th or early 7th century. But again, even that, people dispute exactly what the date was.
You bring up the work of Samuel Butler, who suggested in the 19th century that the Odyssey must have been written by a woman because it has portrays women in such a kind of sympathetic manner. So I'm just wondering, what's your own gut on that? Because there's so many different theories on the text itself, and again on the authorship and some of the kind of the influences.
My thought is that I think the idea that only women would bother to write about women, I think that's a little bit problematic. Also, the idea which Butler also brings up, that he claims that the fighting scenes in the Odyssey are no good. So again, that proves that it must be written by a girl. I don't think there was a particularly good argument. The fact that we don't have any evidence whatsoever for archaic epic composers being female, I think quite counts to some extent against the theory. I mean, it means that it's pure speculation based on somewhat less than nothing. I think it's quite possible that over the course of the many centuries that these myths were being composed, might there have been some elite women who participated in the construction of the myth. That seems perfectly possible. But that's a far cry from saying the author of the Odyssey, if we can even use the word author, was a woman. I don't think that's very, very unlikely.
But Penelope, Odysseus's long-suffering wife, is such an extraordinarily interesting character, not alone in terms of her resilience, but in terms of her creativity, her patience, how she's very psychologically adept at playing competing forces and holding her own. And she endures so much. So to present a character like Penelope so many hundreds of years ago was absolutely groundbreaking, really.
Well, it's hard to say what's groundbreaking, right? If we don't have literature from, or you know, recorded voices from before the Odyssey, how do we know if it's groundbreaking? Right? I mean, there's no ground before that. But it's certainly true that I think both Penelope and all the other female characters in this poem are totally fully realised. They're rounded human beings. That we have this both of a fascinating sense that on some level Penelope is always veiled. She's always behind the literal veils, and also her mind is veiled partly from herself as well as from other people, that she's constantly in the grip of desires and wishes which are ambivalent and hard to keep track of, and also that she's always constrained in certain ways by her own position socially. But which of course is not true of the female divine characters, or even of Helen, who's semi-divine. Those female characters are given this very different model of agency. But of course, the question of to what extent did people in ancient Greece or people in archaic Greece respond to that as challenging in some way to an androcentric society? I don't know. I mean, it's sort of hard to say that, right? Because we don't know, we don't have contemporary reception of the Homeric poems. We have much, much, much later reception of the poems.
How would you describe Calypso?
She's one of the many female fascinating characters. She's the goddess on whose island Odysseus spends 7 years. She's a cave goddess called a nymph. So the nature goddesses in ancient Greek mythology are called nymphs. So they're either associated with water, with rivers, with seas, or with caves. And she has a couple of wonderful speeches insisting that there's a double standard in the, among the gods on Mount Olympus, because when male gods take up with a mortal female, they get to do whatever they want, whereas when a female goddess takes up with a mortal man, there's usually trouble and the other gods usually insist that she has to die. So she complains when Hermes comes, sent by Zeus, to say that she has to send Odysseus back and she has to lose the man that she's done all this work to rescue, push out of the sea and keep with her. So I think she's a wonderfully impassioned, and we see both her power and her vulnerability in a way that's really, I think, gripping and moving.
I might get you to read some of Calypso, because she's such an extraordinary character, and as you mentioned there, her vulnerability. You know, she's there's so many sides to her, but her emotional side is so interesting and so real, and her demands are so real that, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of women who could relate to her.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, and I think one can relate to both sides in the relationship too. I mean, one can relate both to the Odysseus who wants to get out of the relationship and to the person who wants the relationship not to end. I think both sides are very, very, very described. And I can certainly read part of, so if you read her speech.
Lovely, yeah.
Describing the book. So this is after we've had a marvellous description of Calypso's cave, which maybe I'll just read a couple of lines of that first, just so that you can see how vividly her world is described, which I think is also important for realising how magical she is. But she's not just a woman being dumped. She's not a woman. She's a goddess, and she has enormous power. So she's in her cave. The scent of citrus and of brittle pine suffused the island. Inside, she was singing and weaving with a shuttle made of gold. Her voice was beautiful. Around the cave, a luscious forest flourished. Alder, poplar, and scented cypress. It was full of wings. Birds nested there, but hunted out at sea. The owls, the hawks, the gulls with gaping beaks. A ripe and verdant vine hung thick with grapes and stretched a coil around her cave. Four springs spurted with sparkling water as they laced with crisscrossed currents intertwined together. The meadow softly bloomed with celery and violets. So I think you can also see in that description how she's the goddess whose name means hiding, and she both is hidden and is the source of hiding. But then when after Hermes comes to tell her that he has instructions from Zeus that she has to let Odysseus go, this is what she says. Calypso shuddered and let fly at him. You cruel, jealous gods! You bear a grudge whenever any goddess takes a man to sleep with as a lover in her bed. Just so the gods who live at ease were angry when rosy-fingered Dawn took up Orion and from her golden throne chased Artemis, the tact, and killed him with her gentle arrows. Demeter, with the corn sprouts in her hair, indulged her own desire, and she made love with Yastian in triple-furrowed fields, till Zeus found out, hurled flashing flame, and killed him. So now, you male gods are upset with me for living with a man I saved. Zeus pinned his ship and with his flash of lightning smashed it to pieces. All his friends were killed out on the wind-dark sea. This man alone, clutching the keel, was swept by wind and wave and came here to my home. I cared for him and loved him, and I vowed to set him free from time and death forever. Still, I know no other god can change the will of Zeus. So let him go, if that is Zeus's order, across a barren sea. I will not give an escort for this trip across the water. I have no ship or rowers. But I will share what I know with him and gladly give useful advice, so he can safely reach his home.
It's terrific stuff. And in a lot of ways, you could possibly argue that, you know, she gets him way more than maybe Penelope, the wife. What do you think?
In certain ways, yes. I mean, we don't know exactly how long have they been married before he leaves with Penelope.
Yeah.
I think what we constantly get from Penelope and her perspectives on her marriage is that she's constantly defining her marriage by loss.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, just as Calypso also defines the relationship in terms of loss, but Calypso also defines it in terms of what she was able to achieve, what she was able to do for Odysseus. Mm. Whereas Penelope, the relationship is defined by both how he abandoned her for 20 years, how much her face and her bed are marked by grief and by tears,
yeah,
and how even when she's speaking to him disguised, he makes her cry already, even before he's revealed who he is. And then when they get back together, the way the relationship works, that they reunite, is that he talks about their olive tree bed that he built. It's a bed defined as his bed, and it's a bed which is which shows his artistry, his capacity to join nature with art. So I think that it's very clear that the choice to leave Calypso also is a choice to leave a world in which Odysseus could be immortal, but he would have to be subject to somebody more powerful than himself. Whereas once, in going back to Ithaca, there's nobody at Ithaca once he's achieved his end and killed all the suitors and tried to dominate the place again. There's going to be nobody more powerful than him. So the choice to come back to Ithaca is partly a choice to be that particular kind of hero, the powerful man whose story is the most important story.
Irrespective that she's a goddess, what I really liked about Calypso is that she's very realistic and pragmatic, and she sees Odysseus and all his faults, and she loves him, and she's realistic within her love. And that is very consoling.
It's lovely. I mean, it's lovely also that she's very aware that one of the things they have in common, maybe the central thing they have in common, is that they both like hiding themselves. They both like trickery. And that, of course, is a central feature in each of Odysseus's important relationships. It's a central feature of his relationship with Athena as well, that they both love being in disguise and tricking each other and seeing through disguises from other people. And it's a feature of his relationship with Circe, Calypso, and I guess Helen as well. And it's a feature of his relationship with Penelope as well, to some extent, because of course Penelope constructs the famous trick whereby she tricks her suitors, saying that she can't marry any of them until she's finished weaving a shroud for her father-in-law Laertes when he dies. And so every day she performs her weaving on the web, and then every night she unpicks it. So it's a cunning trick, which is a delaying trick. It manages to stave them off, although only for 3 years. So in a way, it's similar to the way her husband operates, that it's by trickery, by deceit. But it's also different from the way her husband operates, in that it's about creating inaction. It's a trick whose only purpose is to stop something from happening. Whereas if you think about the various things that Odysseus manages to construct, his various devices or mechani, they're all about actually getting somewhere. He constructs a raft, he constructs a bed, he constructs a wooden horse. Those achieve particular ends, whereas Penelope's trick is achieving stagnation. So I think there are ways that with the various goddesses and their capacities for trickery, those are also capacities which can get them places because they have so much more power than she does. All she can achieve by her trickery is to stave things off for a while.
There's about 100 different men in Odysseus, and as you say, he's very good at tricks and deceit, and you know, he's a master of deception when he wants to, and he makes some monumentally crazy decisions throughout the narrative. But within that, is it that, you know, that he is so complex, he's so accomplished, he's so multi-layered in so many different ways, that's why he's such an enjoyable character?
It's one of the great pleasures of the poem is just seeing how many, so you don't get bored of this character, because at every moment he's going to come up with another trick or tell another lie. I mean, it's like reading about Br'er Rabbit or these various other trickster characters, but with an element of storytelling about it, but he's also, in a way, a master poet. The central books of the poem are told by him. And so he's very different from any other Homeric character in that he has many different epithets, but of course most Homeric characters have a sort of standard thing that they're famous for, like their superpower. And for Achilles, the superpower is being swift-footed, which also goes with being short-lived, that he's going very, very fast towards a particular goal, which ultimately is both honour and death. And he's always described as swift-footed Achilles. Whereas Odysseus has many different things, and they're all to do with his manyness, that he's constantly polymetis, polymekanos. The poly means many. So he's many stratagemed, many, many cunning intelligence, many, many different things he can do, many stories he can tell, many personae he can inhabit. And then combined with that also is this way that he is, he's willing, for instance, most obviously in the episode with the Cyclops, Polyphemus, he's willing to pretend to be nobody at all. And that capacity to give up his name or to be somebody else is what enables him to survive.
And he's so wonderfully hard to pin down. Although Tina, the goddess of strategic thinking, is well up for him, isn't she?
Yes, yes. I mean, I love the conversation that they have in book 13, which is when he gets back to Ithaca. And he doesn't realise he's back in Ithaca because, of course, she's disguised the island. So the first of the many recognitions has to be Odysseus struggling to recognise his own place. But he can't, and he can't do that at first because Athena's tricked him. And she also manages to display to him how much better than better at disguises, better at seeing through disguises she is than him, even though that's his superpower, but she's better at it. So they both are known for this quality of, as you say, strategic thinking, which in Greek is metis, and also mekane, that Athena is the daughter of the goddess Metis, the goddess of cunning intelligence, who was swallowed by Zeus because Zeus didn't want her children to be more powerful than he was. So he's retained her power within himself, and then from Zeus's head, from that union, comes Athena. So that part of the close connection between Athena and Odysseus is that they share this quality of cunning intelligence, of always being the smartest person in the room. And he has it to the maximum degree that a human being could have it, and she has it as a goddess. So, of course, that's even better.
You argue in your introductions, Emily, that the poem circles around the question of whether an elite woman's worth depends entirely on sexual fidelity. And you go into one of the big questions within the narrative that, you know, when Odysseus is telling his wife Penelope about his epic voyage, he does strategically decide not to mention any of the messing with Calypso and some of the more interesting aspects of that voyage. So I'm just wondering, how do you feel all about that as a woman translator, as a female translator?
It's not like it's very surprising that, of course, there is this double standard. I mean, I think what's interesting to me is, I mean, I'm not sure if it's interesting to me as a woman, it's just interesting to me how this is one of many double standards that there are in the poem. There are also other double standards that have to do with poverty and class and how we treat strangers. What's interesting to me is just how precisely the poem seems to articulate the double standard, but it's not that it sort of shies away from... is an androcentric society one in which women are perfectly happy with their subordinate role? And what's so fascinating, as we've talked already about, is how miserable Penelope is, how constrained she is. So to me, it's not exactly surprising that, of course, the poem depicts her as being in a constrained position. That doesn't seem surprising. And the idea that, of course, Odysseus is going to justify his own position and that we're going to be shown... him justifying himself, that again is not very surprising. I think what's surprising is that we get so many perspectives which cast other kinds of light on that we see her grief as well as his power. And that we see also that, of course, there are different kinds of meanings to loyalty, fidelity, honesty, and truth, depending on whether you're male or female. And of course, sexual fidelity matters in a different way for women in this poem than for men. Such that if you care about the household and you think the household depends on the power of the man over his legitimate children, then what a man does outside the house doesn't matter. Whereas what a woman does in terms of, is she going to sleep with one of the suitors and destroy the household, that does matter for the sake of the household. So I think what's interesting to me is less, isn't it unfair? Because, of course it's unfair. But just the way that the poem is so precise in tracing out, why does this work? How does this work? How do these various different characters feel entirely differently about it? And also the fact that we have the immortal realm as well, I think gives a very really interesting different perspective on it. Because, for instance, we have the insert narrative in Book 8 of the extramarital love affair between Aphrodite and Ares, in which the cheated on husband, Hephaestus, gets back, traps the lovers in his bed. So in a way, he performs the part of Odysseus coming back and getting rid of the suitors. But in the divine realm, the love affair between the wife and the adulterer, it's no big deal. Aphrodite is totally fine. She puts on some amazing oil and puts on a beautiful dress, and she goes back to her other cult center on her island, and she's fine. It's all okay. So I think it also shows you how the particular dynamics of the constraints on mortal women are dependent on a particular social construct. The poem is aware that if we were all gods, the rules would be different.
And in relation to that double standard, it wouldn't make sense that, you know, if Odysseus came back, given his kind, he's, you know, he's such a pragmatic fellow, that it makes sense that he is a bit, you know, strategic and a bit sketchy with the truth. And after all, he does turn up years and years later. The bigger picture is, although you could possibly think that maybe Penelope was a bit naive.
I'm not sure that I do see her as naive. I think I see her as very aware of the choices she doesn't have. I mean, she refers, when she's acknowledging him back as her husband, to Helen, who made the opposite choice. And the poem sets up how, for an elite woman with a husband who's absent at war, you have these three choices. You have the choice that Helen makes of go off with somebody else. And then you may start a war, there may be trouble for other people, it may be a whole big bother, and then you may end up with your old husband anyway. And Penelope points out that in that speech that if Helen had realized the bad consequences, then maybe she wouldn't have done it. Maybe she was impelled by a goddess, maybe she didn't fully think it through. And then the other choice that the woman could have is to do a Clytemnestra and just kill the husband when he gets back, and then it would solve the problem. And that, of course, in the terms of the poem, is the wrong choice. And, of course, several of the male characters, including the dead husband himself, speak out against that choice. But I think those are three not very good choices, right? I mean, either you just wait forever, keep crying forever, or you marry somebody else and you don't know what the consequences are going to be. It could be bad. Or you kill the husband. It's going to be bad. It's not that Penelope, I think, is not aware. Her epithet, in contrast to the epithets of Odysseus, which have to do with sneaky, cunning, strategic intelligence. Her descriptive terms have to do with intelligence, but they have to do with different kinds of intelligence. It has to do with all-around awareness. She's periphrone, which is often translated as prudent, or it's sort of thinking around everything. She has a kind of awareness which I think actually constrains her, that even further than she's already constrained. She knows that whatever she does, there's going to be problems with it.
In your introductions, you bring up the theme of permanence, and you say something on the lines of that the Odyssey makes a paradoxical set of claims about the possibility of permanence, either in relationships or in the lives of any individual person. I thought that was extraordinarily interesting. Can you talk me through that?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think it's a fascinating, I mean, we've talked about various ways it resonates with sort of contemporary issues. And I think this is one of the central things for me about both identity and about conservatism, about stopping time. So Odysseus, as we've said, has this, he's depicted as somebody who can be constantly changing, constantly trying to change himself into somebody else. But it seems also as if the poem is suggesting that all of those changes are in the service of getting back to the self that he was 20 years ago, and the self not just in himself, but also in all his relationships. But even though 20 years have passed, you might think that things would have changed at home, things have changed, but he can fix that. He can kill all the invaders. He can reestablish his marriage on exactly the same footing that it was 20 years ago, reestablish his relationship with his son, with his husband. Everything can be exactly the same as it was 20 years ago. And I think the poem is also showing us the ways that that fantasy might not fully work. Most obviously in the way that Penelope constantly says that she's marked by tears, that she's changed by grief, that she's not actually the same as she was 20 years ago. But we also see it, for instance, in the ways that the dog has, this is one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the poem, right? That Argos the dog has been waiting for his old owner Odysseus to come back for 20 years, and he finally sniffs him and hears his voice and pricks up his ears, and then he dies. Because in fact, for dogs, you can't stop time, you can't turn back to the way you were 20 years ago, because that's a whole lifetime. So I think it's also playing around with this question of, even without being immortal, even without staying with Calypso forever, is it possible for a human being to be themselves, fully themselves, despite whatever changes, over the course of this long, decades-long period? Or might it be that maybe through no choice of your own, through the things that happen to you, the people you meet, the things that are imposed on you, the situations that are imposed on you, might things actually change you?
It's such an interesting question, and you know, whether, as you mentioned, with the different locations that you may visit, the relationships you have, the children you bring into the world, whatever it is, the idea of identity and how fluid it all is, isn't it? It's so evolving.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Yes, and identity, and I guess one of the questions that we haven't brought up yet is that, of course, Odysseus is a veteran of a 10-year war. So, yeah. So there are also the questions about to what extent is he shaped by that experience as a warrior? Mm. And also to what extent can he be the same man that he was on the battlefield when he's back in his own house? Or to what extent can he be that same man that he was when he was a fighter, killer, giving speeches to soldiers once he's encountering new kinds of threats?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the scenes that I think speaks most vividly to this is when Odysseus encounters first the sirens and then Scylla and Charybdis. And he hears the sirens singing the song, which is the promise of total knowledge of everything, like the internet, but also even more explicitly knowledge of whatever's happening at Troy. So it's a promise of a total epic song and of knowledge of that self, of the self who was fighting at Troy, glorious at Troy. Mm. And Odysseus is very tempted by that. He wants to go back to being in that story rather than moving on to being in a different story. And then when he's encountering the six-headed monster Scylla and the whirlpool Charybdis, again, he wants to be the warrior self, to put on his armor, even though he's been told that's not going to work against a whirlpool. He still puts on the armor and tries to be all glorious and military. And that doesn't actually stop six of his men being eaten. So I think it also sort of raises questions about to what extent can you change your behaviors? And if you can, does that mean you lose something in your identity?
And Odysseus, you know, it can be quite savage in parts, quite violent in parts, and then he reflects on that. But I suppose we have to look at all of that and also the portrayal of slavery within the text as part of the, I suppose, look at it within its historical context, don't we?
Sure, we sure do, yes. I mean, I guess what I would also want to say about that is that, yes, absolutely, it depicts a violent and militaristic society. It depicts a slave-owning society. I think that the fact that, of course, there wasn't an abolition movement in antiquity, there wasn't a pacifist movement in antiquity and anything like the way that modern Quakerism worked, that didn't exist in antiquity. That's all absolutely true, and we have to sort of be aware that those are features of archaic Greek society. I think we also then don't have to go the other direction of simplifying and say that because there were slaves in antiquity, therefore anything that may seem troubling about slavery in the text can't really be there, because whatever's in the text is there in the text. And it seems to me that it's fascinating how we get the voices of slaves in this text.
Yeah.
Of course, they're slaves in a poem which presumably wasn't composed by slaves. But even so, that it gives us some kind of perspective onto what is their world like, and how, in what ways do they suffer? What do they feel? What do they think? What do they want? And similarly, also about violence, that it's not that there's absolute acceptance of every single time somebody gets murdered in a violent way. That's all cool because it's ancient times. That's not actually the way it's depicted.
Yeah.
It's depicted that there are various different ways that it can be horrifying when somebody meets a violent early death. And we see very clearly, I think, how each of the suitors is a human being. And we see how Odysseus is very keen to present his actions in killing all of them as an act of justice. But I think the text complicates that in various different ways. For instance, the way that one of the suitors, Amphinomus, wants to get away when he sees that the prophecies are all turning the wrong way. He wants to leave. He thinks this is a bad idea to stay in this house. And Athena makes him stay because she wants to increase her own glory and that of Odysseus. So I think we're shown very clearly that there isn't a clear connection between ethics and slaughtering people. And we see that also very clearly in the murders of the slaves at the end of Book 22, that those are presented as very different kinds of killings, which don't have to do with this person chose to do something unjust. They have much more to do with reclaiming ownership over the household. So I think we have to not to think because it's ancient times, we must think there's nothing morally troubling about it, which seems to me really bogus. People in antiquity were not more primitive than people nowadays.
I'm just wondering though, Emily, you know, the text, you know, parachutes between the real and the unreal. We get cannibals, we get witches, we get goddesses, all extraordinarily interesting. But, you know, reading this, some people say, oh, well, maybe Homer wrote it, maybe Homer didn't write it. But they would possibly, you know, presume that, you know, the poem reflects, you know, real historical events, culture, people, whatever it is, people's whatever it is, that, you know, that we can look at it as a kind of a clearly a text from history that we can read history through it. So how do you feel about all of that?
I think it's very complex to do. I mean, I think it's not that there's clearly no one-on-one correspondence between the Homeric poems and any particular historical reality. I mean, just linguistically, the Homeric poems have language from several different eras as well as several different dialects. So they clearly don't reflect the language that any person at any particular time, any particular place ever spoke. They're certainly not that. Just archaeologically, we know that the material culture of the Homeric poems, again, doesn't represent a consistent reality from one particular period. It's several periods muddled up together. It's several periods, even just in terms of what are the marriage customs, what are the burial customs. They're not consistent because it's not a consistent reflection of a single society or a single moment in society. And even just in terms of the places, where exactly does this take place? Some of the geography, even beyond the mythical part, of course, there is no such place as the ocean running all the way around the world. There's no such place as the land of the dead. But even in terms of where exactly is Ithaca and what is there a real cave on Ithaca that's exactly like the one in the Odyssey? You know, I think there's real questions about all of that. People used to try very hard to do Homeric geography and locate everything in Homer in real places. I have a colleague who spent most of his career excavating at Troy, and I remember him telling me about how one time they uncovered some troughs, and several people were saying, "Oh, maybe these are the baths in which Andromache washed Hector in the Iliad." And in fact, of course, they turned out to be Roman imperial baths, which had nothing whatsoever to do with Homer. It just seems to me that. Yes, it's quite possible that there's some very vague folk memory of Mycenaean civilization in the looking back to an earlier, grander age in these poems. That Mycenaean civilization had, which was a civilization based on great palaces and had a form of writing in an earlier era of the Greek-speaking world, fell, and perhaps these poems, these myths about the heroes of olden times, maybe they look back to that period. But I think that's very different from saying this is a historical record. It's clearly not a historical record of anything. Maybe these poems are also, and I think they are, grappling with sort of social questions that were vibrant at the time about should we be an oligarchy, should we be a tyranny, to what extent is, to what kinds of class culture are we working with, and also what kinds of colonization practices are okay, what kinds are not okay. How should we deal with all these different foreign cultures that we Greek speakers are encountering as we're expanding across the Mediterranean world? I think those questions are, you know, questions which were historically there for whoever it was that was composing these poems, and they make their way into the poems. But I don't think they're sort of a one-on-one, because XYZ person did that, therefore they wrote it down like a diary. It's not like a diary.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British classicist, writer and translator Emily Wilson, whose new translation of The Odyssey has just been published by W.W. Norton & Company. I asked Emily about her approach to verse form and how she went about it all.
So one of the big reasons why I took the project on at all is that I was aware that most translations from contemporary periods that people read of Homer and also other classical verse texts are either in prose, which doesn't reflect the rhythmicality of the original at all, or free verse, which again doesn't reflect the regular rhythmicality of the original. The Homeric poems are in dactylic hexameter, which is the normal form for narrative verse in the archaic Greek context. So I wanted to use the normal form for metrical, regularly metrical narrative and dramatic verse in Anglophone poetry, which is iambic pentameter. So I used iambic pentameter all the way through, and I also kept the same line number, the same number of lines as the original, because the pacing of Homer also seemed to be central. So there's formal considerations. If I wanted to whether you read it out loud or read it to yourself, I want you to hear the rhythm in every line to have it, for it to have a predictable rhythm. And also I wanted it to have a that quick pace which comes with not expanding on the original.
And Emily, I'm looking at some of the wonderful maps that you have in the book, and I'm looking at the world of the Odyssey, and it's a terrific map, and it really adds to the reading experience because you're piecing together the narrative through the map, which is a really interesting thing to do. But I might ask you, I know several European women have translated Homer's The Odyssey, but I think you're the first woman to translate it into the English language. Is that right?
Yes, at least I'm certainly the first woman to translate it, to publish a translation in English. And I've been asking around for, you know, the last 10 years about whether anybody knows of one, you know, stuck in a drawer somewhere by some other woman. And I haven't come across it. So, I think I am the first to do a translation in English, like a literary published translation. It's interesting how much the media coverage is focused on that. And I think it's really important both to notice that gender matters. But I also think, you know, one can get to reductive places by that. I want to celebrate women's achievements, you know, not just mine, but other women too, and to recognize that I'm not the only female classicist, I'm not the only female Homerist either. There are plenty of women who worked on Homer before me, and there will be plenty of women who work on Homer after me. And it also seems to be really important to recognize that not all women are the same. That, in fact, Caroline Alexander was the first woman to publish a translation of the Iliad a couple of years before my translation of the Odyssey. And her style in terms of translation is completely different from mine. Such that I think the idea that there's a female perspective or there's a female way of translating Homer, there certainly isn't. There is, you know, women are just as different as men are. And I don't think that everything is sort of predetermined by if you're a woman, therefore, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me that what matters more is that I do have some interest in thinking about gender and thinking about both my own gender identities and a relationship to those gender identities, and also thinking through how is gender depicted in the text. I think that makes a difference. I'm not sure that being female in itself predetermines anything about whether you have a perspective that is noticeably on the page different from the perspective of X, Y, Z, A, B, C, however many down the alphabet you want to go, male perspective. It's important that we never ask men about their gender. You know, we never say, as a male translator, as a male journalist, or as a male producer, how do you think about this as a man? You know, and yet we always ask women that question.
It is so reductive, and surely it is basically an intellectual response to the Odyssey, a new intellectual response. And within that, you know, every different reader, irrespective of gender, brings in different moral understandings, different social understandings, different philosophical or ethical or reasoned understandings. So those are the questions that we should be asking in terms of new insights and new directions, rather than being so reductive on gender. I'm just wondering, though, within the overall story, you do touch on the fact that, you know, the ending is a little incomplete. You know, we don't get a nice, tidy fix up at the end. The world isn't all safe and perfect. And some readers have been very frustrated by the ending. But surely the ending offers a more realistic view of life and the continuum that is life.
Yes, when I first read The Odyssey, I think I first read it in translation as a teenager, and then over various other readings of the poem in Greek, I think I was disappointed by the ending for a while, you know, when I was younger, and I don't think I am anymore. So Aristarchus, who was the first great Homeric critic in antiquity, who lived in Hellenistic Alexandria, said that the poem ought to end with the reunion of Penelope and Odysseus in book 23, and that the rest didn't really belong there. And you know, many people have thought the same thing. I kind of like that it goes on. I like that it shows us that there isn't a sort of clear path to how exactly is this very violent way of coming home going to be resolved. Doesn't it mean that he's established, Odysseus has established control over his own household at the expense of killing a lot of people who had households of their own to which they're not going to go home anymore? And of course, their families are devastated by loss rather than happy that there's a homecoming. Because there's one person's homecoming comes at the cost of many other people not having a home or having a home that's destroyed by murder. So I think it shows us just how consequences to actions don't actually end. Like, you don't just sort of suddenly, I've done one thing and that's the end of the story.
Last question for you, Emily. Do you think we'll still be reading the Odyssey, responding to the Odyssey and questioning the Odyssey in 102 years' time? Like, do you think it'll still endure all the changes in technology, how we're living and our time and capacity to sit down with a text and read through it?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think it's endured this long because it has so many different levels and layers and themes and characters within it, so many different ways of reading it. And I know that the way that I read and interpret and approach the poem is very different from the way that, you know, say Alexander Pope translated the poem in the 18th century. And I'm sure that whatever speaks to us out of this poem will be different in 100 years. It isn't we can predict that, because we can't predict what will people's lives be like in 100 years.
British classicist, writer and translator Emily Wilson. The Odyssey, translated by Emily Wilson, is published by W.W. Norton & Company and retails for just under €28 in hardback or €20 on a Kindle. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Jojo on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with the words of Emily Wilson from her wonderful introductions to the Odyssey. I have tried to make sure that a reader can feel inside the characters in the poem to convey the ways that each character in the poem has her or his own distinct point of view. Admirably achieved. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.